This is for you. It's your body, your passion, your life. Whether you're chasing your own dream or helping someone else get there, there's now a hub where training, nutrition, trends, and science come together, where goals become realities. Welcome to Iron Man U.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, RunCatalina.com, the Challenged Athletes Foundation, where we've raised over $65 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. You can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. Our next guest, a three-time Tour de France finisher, and every single July, he becomes one of the voices of the Tour de France for all of us, Mr. Bob Roll. Bob Key, how the heck are you?
Doing pretty well. I've recovered from the Tour de France, so, you know, the cyclist, it takes, I think, less time to recover when you're racing it.
Do you find that? Because you raced it. Is it take a long time to recover as a broadcaster? Because you guys are working just as hard.
I mean, obviously, at the time, it's not as hard. And the recovery is relative. You know, you don't have to go on to something else as you have to do when you're a cyclist. So, you know, when you're racing, very few guys finish their season with the Tour de France, and
right.
There's still a big calendar after the Tour. And when you're broadcasting, it seems like you don't have the physical gratification of having accomplished it. So for me, it takes longer emotionally to sort of filter through everything that's transpired and, you know, remind myself of some of the things I should have said and some of the good things and some of the not so good things and some of the good days and some of the days, you know, where you just, you know, your mind is turned to oatmeal and you're hanging on for dear life. So,
so who from this year's tour, obviously each year there's always surprises and there's always people who you sort of think are going to do great. When you came away from this year's tour, who impressed you, who surprised you to begin with?
For me, was a nice surprise how well he raced, how tough he was, how the peloton attacked him and his teammates throughout the 3 weeks, and how they were able to do what they needed to without, you know, getting too emotionally involved in some of the aggressive racing. So that showed a level of maturity that hadn't seen from Chris Froome. And when you're climbing as well as he does, then you're a very tough person to beat. And so his patience and forbearance and his trust in his teammates was really impressive. And he did exactly what he needed to do for the whole 3 weeks, every single day of the race. And that was a really pleasant surprise. He seemed to be a little bit more high-strung last year and the year before that. And in 2012, when you know, Bradley Wiggins was leading the team and Chris had great legs and wanted to go and held himself back. And it just seemed emotionally he was a lot more mature this year. And that helped him win an incredibly arduous, physically demanding Tour de France, maybe the toughest in many, many years, considering how much climbing there was and how hard the stages between the mountain stages were. They were incredibly hard. There was no easy day for 3 weeks.
Wow.
And a day.
Yeah.
And Froome handled it all with real class and real grace, and it was impressive to watch.
So when you look back at your career, I mean, you started out in Northern California, cross country, track, running with a guy who went on to become one of the best triathletes in history, Scott Molina. You guys were out doing long bike rides together. And when did you move from being a runner to falling in love with the bike?
I think Scott and I both sort of harbored these dreams of track and field or cross country or marathon. on grandeur, but unless you're one of the best three or four in the world.
Yes, yeah.
Not just in the country, not just in any country, but in the world, then it's almost impossible to make money. It's virtually impossible to have a job or a career doing that. And so Scott moved into triathlon, had an absolutely spectacular career, and I moved into, you know, bike racing and happened to be at the right place at the right time with the development of the 7-Eleven team and subsequently the Motorola team. And so I was able to make, you know, a decent living, a pretty good living doing something that I love to do. And Scott, you know, he just was an absolute phenom in triathlon. And I followed every minute of his career, and it was great to watch Scott Molina dismantle the field. I mean, he had that run when, you know, the Olympic distance half. Yep. Ironman, where he just destroyed people week in, week out for years, and that was awesome.
So what's interesting to me is here you are, a guy who's not having a ton of success as a cyclist in the U.S., right? And the U.S. at that time was almost double A, and major leagues was Europe. So the mentality is, I'm not great here. I'm going to go to the majors, and I'll make a living over there. Talk me through the mindset that the Bob Roll, you know, sort of the blender in between the years, it goes, okay, I'm average here. Yeah. I'm going to go where the very best in the world is, and I'll be better there.
It's a good question. There's a couple of things. One is purely physiological explanation, in that the races in Europe are longer and more arduous, with more climbing and much tougher conditions.
Yeah.
And the races in the United States were much more technical, much faster, much shorter, and dominated by a couple of strong teams. So there wasn't a lot of opportunity, honestly, in North America. And for me, being better at a much longer event, I needed to go to Europe to be successful. I couldn't have ever become a crit specialist and done well in North America. That just was not going to happen. And emotionally, like, as far as my idea of the sport was like being a basketball star in Italy. You know, you want to be in the NBA. You want to use your resources and energy at doing the best where the best races are. And so those two things, and it looks true because the guys in the Berkeley Bike Club that I rode with, I saw Perry Bay on TV. I said, I'm doing that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at that point, I had been dropped on every club run.
And then you're going
to the Berkeley Bike Club, and they're like, yeah, right.
Two years
later, they were sitting there in the bike shop watching ABC. I was the only guy on American to finish.
Oh, that is so funny.
You're right. It was impossible to predict that I would make.
But when you went over there, you go to Europe, you're basically living in a tent. You're not even part of a team. And I remember talking to Davis Finney, and he's like, yeah, Bob was sort of living in a tent, and we were looking for a guy, and, you know, we put Bob on the team. What was great about Bob is, one, he picked up languages in a heartbeat. And everybody in the Peloton loved the guy because he spoke everybody's language. And he goes, you could always tell where Bob Key was in the Peloton because there was this huge gap around him. Because besides the fact that everybody loved talking to him, they all knew he couldn't handle a bike. So they all, like, left him a lot of room.
Well, that was on purpose, a couple of, because it gets really tight.
Yeah.
You know, and you see what happens in day in and day out in professional cycling. Like, you have to fight for your position tooth and nail, or you're 50 guys back and you're in a big pileup. So I sort of did that on purpose, you know, like,
right.
Just so we could have a little bit more space. And, you know, if people got near me, they had to think twice, like, oh, I mean, it's not a great place to be, because I will lean on people, plow into them, and, you know, happen to be resilient enough to have any traumatic injuries. But, you know, that could have gone either way at any time, any race for years. So that was lucky. And then speaking languages, I just, studied Spanish
Yep.
In junior high, or we call it intermediate school. I don't know if they have intermediate school in their, even if they don't have it in California anymore, but we had elementary school.
Yep.
Where in those days, nobody, I don't know if there was any foreign languages offered. And then there was French and Spanish offered in intermediate school, which was seventh and eighth grade, and high school also. So I took Spanish in intermediate school, and I think that helped to learn or at least understand Italian and French. And then because of having that, you know, ability to listen in a different way than you're used to, helped me to understand what was being said in Germany if we were there, or in the Netherlands, or in Belgium, or Luxembourg, or you know, and Russians, Eastern Bloc routers started coming over.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to communicate with them. And so I think Davis is referring to, you know, that.
Yeah, exactly.
That, like, and that helped us to understand what was going on in the races a little bit better, too, because no, it wasn't English, wasn't hardly spoken at all in those days in the peloton, like almost nobody. So I think that helped us tactically a lot to know what was going on and just to be able to find the freaking hotel or where dinner was.
Right.
You know, so that was, yeah, it was a big help for the team. But for me, it was really fun, you know, to be able to understand what people were saying and speak to the other riders. And cycling is a very social, you know, day in, day out, year in, year out with a bunch of guys, like constantly, like
right.
for hours. And you're not always racing flat out. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of talking.
A lot of social time, yeah.
Yeah, so now they don't, there's not as much social time.
Yeah, they're going hard every second.
So hard.
Yeah.
And the races are shorter and,
right.
you know, and faster. So, but when we were racing, it was a great skill to have, and I think it helped our team a lot, you know, in its own way.
So talk a little bit about that. When you guys, the first American team was Team 7-Eleven. And the European teams had huge support. You guys were over there, you know, sort of trying to figure things out. Like you said, you don't speak the language. The other folks don't speak the language. I think I remember you were telling me one story once where you guys are like waiting at the starting line for a race is about to start, and you guys don't have your bikes. Your team guy is like not just late, he's like days late.
That was a tour of England, yeah, we were like, oh, I guess we're not doing it. And the race promoter was, like, in a panic. He's like, and that's Phil Liggett, you know, it's his race.
Oh, it was Phil Liggett's race. Oh, that's funny.
And he's like, Robert, where have your bicycles gone? And I'm like, I'm so sorry. Well, we left. When we left Denmark, we had them, but... And so we had to by hook or crook get to where we needed to be. So that, yeah, a lot of that happened all the time. But I was constantly, and you know, not speaking the languages and going to a different continent and doing something no one had ever done before was something that you can't do again because it's already happened, and was great to be a part of. Really. And that we survived it and
yeah.
actually started doing pretty well is miraculous.
Well, and the funny part is, in I think it was 88 when Andy Hampson wins the Giro, and you were the guy who basically was the domestique shuttling back and forth getting Andy stuff, and it was freezing, right? So you're having, here, Bob, you go take these five water bottles up to Andy and bring him more clothes. And meanwhile, was it one of the tougher days you had ever had on a bike?
Well, that particular day in the Giro was different because it was basically a blizzard.
Right.
At the top of the two mountain passes when we went over, and bitter, bitter freezing rain in the valley and, you know, between them, and then along 30 kilometers, bitter cold, snowy descent off the top of the Gavia Pass into Bormio. So that was a unique day, and it required a lot of, you know, extra precautions that I was able at that, you know, that day to help Andy as best I could. But the whole 3.5 weeks of that Giro was a culmination of everything we had learned with all of the experiences that we had. And that was, you know, that was when it all came together, not just for me or Andy, but for Davis and Ron Kiefel and, right. and Roy Nickman and Jeff Pierce had a spectacular Giro. And Raul Alcala was absolutely stunning. And, I mean, you look at the roster, you're like, wow,
that's an amazing roster.
That's
Hall of Fame.
Great team. And we all had a spectacular 3 weeks, and Andy, you know, came out on top. And, you know, they raced against us, the entire Italian peloton. We had to do that ourselves. So, you know, there was no trying to defend fifth place in the overall standings and doing tempo. You know, that never happened. Like, it was, you know, the whole field against us. So we needed to have our best race.
Yeah.
and Andy proved to be one of the greatest climbers of all time. And it was an unbelievably mountainous edition of the Giro. Like, every day was mountains. Like, there was like 3 sprint stages.
Oh.
And mountain time trials and mountaintop finishes. And and Andy, I've been thinking about how good of a climber Andy was, and he was a really spectacular climber. I don't know if he gets the credit that he's due for how amazing he was, just pure climbing. Like Quintana, people talk a lot about Nairo Quintana being
right.
a spectacular climber, and Vincenzo Nibali, and Andy was, you know, the measure of any of the best climbers of all time. So that was a great 3 weeks.
What's also interesting to me is the Europeans are so traditional, right? They don't change anything. And we talk about, you know, Greg LeMond winning in 89, and he had the aero helmet, and he had the bars, and he won that final time trial and knocked off Laurent Fignon. But one of the points you brought up a while ago, yeah, he did that on the last stage, but it's not like the bars weren't used earlier in that same tour, or the helmet, or everything else.
Yeah.
And they basically, Laurent Fignon had, what, 2 weeks to try out the new products?
I think Ron Kiefel, you know, triathletes used those.
Starting in 86,
Road leagues.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think it was Ron Kiefel in the Tour DuPont who used them for the first time in a professional bicycle race, professional road race, and won the time trial. And we went all in, like, holy cow, Wookie beat Eric Van der Aarden.
Yeah.
And all of, you know, the European guys. And Ron was a great bike racer, but we thought, like, and Wookie himself said, wow, I can't believe I just did that. and so, you know, in going into the 89 tour, we did the Giro to get ready for it.
Yep.
And Andy didn't want to use them because he thought the Europeans would see what a big advantage they were. And Andy actually was wrong about that.
Yeah, right.
Because Greg took almost 3 minutes out of Fignon in the first long time trial, and Fignon chipped away at Greg's lead.
Yep.
And eventually got it back, got the yellow jersey back, but still didn't recognize or didn't believe that one thing could make such a big difference, you know.
Right.
And he had double discs and the low profile, you know, what were called, you know, funny bikes in those
days.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
So up until that point, they thought that they had the best at everything, and so it was impossible for them to change their mindset. And, you know, the minute that happened, though, the whole peloton had aero bars.
That's the funniest thing.
You know, like the next day, every single guy on earth, and it's been like that ever since, and more refined. But I think that I don't know if Greg would have changed his tactics, or if Fignon, you know, if he would have won by 1 second instead of 8 seconds, if Fignon had the bars, or if Greg would have, you know, been able to stick with Fignon in the mountains a little bit better and had more confidence. You know, I don't. Those are intangibles that you can't really say, because the Europeans were reluctant to change that Greg won the 89 tour. I think Greg would have won that, you know,
right,
no matter what, honestly.
So when you look back at the Lance Armstrong era, how do you look back at it? I mean, it's funny because I started covering Lance when he's a 15-year-old triathlete, you know, competing with the best guys, Molina, Tinley, Dave Scott. So I knew what type of athlete the guy was. When you look back at that whole era, obviously it was a great era for the awareness in the U.S. of cycling, right? And I'm sure as a TV guy, there was more buzz around the sport than ever before. How do you personally look back at that era?
Well, it happened that Lance got cancer and he survived.
Yep.
And from the Tour de France, those things transpired. They actually happened. There's a historical record of them happening. And the trouble, and what troubles me is that however you want to present it to people, they haven't come up with an adequate solution. And this is up to the French owners and organizers of the race, the ASO, Amrace Sports Organization, that own the Tour de France, that set out the race course, that sell the rights to the TV networks, that have sponsors, that engage the teams, do the invites. They work with the UCI, but the ASO are the record keepers of the event also.
Right.
So they haven't really come up with an adequate explanation of those 7 years. And, you know, whether you want to put an asterisk by Lance's name, and you're talking about a lot of stage wins,
yep,
and you're talking about a lot of climbs that are done year in and year out in the Tour, not always the same route, obviously. And so there has to be a reckoning of those years. And the Europeans have maybe a less puritanical idea of the athletes involved and, you know, what happened. And Lance's competitors that were presumably doing mostly the same things are in the daily fabric of the Tour de France. You know, Laurent Jalabert is a commentator, and Richard Virenque is a commentator for French television.
Yep.
And it's troubling that one person is being singled out for the sins of an entire generation, and that it doesn't seem fair.
Yeah.
You know, if they want to have a more comprehensive and more inclusive way of explaining everything that happened, then I think that the sport would be better off in the long run. And also, to think that singling out one person is a deterrent is somehow going to make less people take the same path and history has proven that that's not exactly right. You know, the 2006 Tour de France, after Lance had retired, was a disaster.
Yeah.
2007, 2008. I mean, 2008, I almost, like, walked off the set. You know, Ricardo Rico, Leonardo Piepoli, Bernard Cole, Stefan Schumacher. It was just every single time. So if we were to look at the Tour now,
yeah,
the way we were looking at it then, without having a better understanding of what was going on, would be, I don't think it would be necessarily better. You know, it would still be waiting for a reckoning, you know, a lower ebb. And the tide now has gone all the way out.
Yeah.
It's out to the middle of the ocean. So now as it washes back, we can sort of take the best and hopefully disregard the worst things that happened. You know, Michael Rasmussen was asked to remove himself from the Tour de France while he was in the yellow jersey. And I remember commentating on it and thinking to myself, I can't believe this is happening. And to think that only one person is responsible for that, you know, is not the best way to go forward in the anti-doping movement. And so I think when they can figure out a way to represent the results from those years and who's culpable and how we move forward with insisting that athletes aren't tempted in the same way, you know, is important. And so the sport honestly has not done a good job by heaping all of the blame on one person. That's just not a good way to move forward. And when some people are allowed to flourish and others are not, having basically done the same thing is not fair. And so if you're a young rider looking at the history and thinking about how you were going to approach the sport, if you're successful and you don't have to use any pharmaceutical enhancements, if you are riding well and you've never had to resort to that, more power to you. But if you start to feel like you're at a disadvantage, then the sport doesn't really have an alternative for you. You know, it's like, and so if you rewind to the previous generation and they felt like that, they did their best, bread and water, got annihilated every day, and they're like, hey, this is malarkey. You know, this is not working. And essentially, Lance has been told, you are going to fail no matter what. If you don't take drugs in that era, no one ever hears of you. If you take drugs and are successful, we take everything away from you. But that, to me, does not sound like a fair way to go about it. And I think we need to acknowledge what happened. And it would give the chance for the people involved to be more candid about their experiences and their temptations. And then we can better understand, like Luca Paolini, no explanation. Positive for drugs, the tour. You go home and you never hear one more word from the guy, not one single word. Tom Danielson, positive for drugs, does 4 tweets proclaiming his innocence, and then
disappears.
Vanishes.
Yeah.
Like, what's the guy doing?
Really?
Why can't we talk to the guy? Why can't we hear from him? What's so shameful about hearing from the guy? And it's like radio silence from the whole team. And I don't feel like that's the best way to go about it. That it has to be a better way. And acknowledging that these things happen is the first step. And moving forward is something that has to be agreed upon by everybody and rigorously enforced by the governing bodies. And that has not happened yet. And this sort of different standards of punishment, of, you know, reconciliation and retribution, those have to be narrowed so that everybody faces the same environment. And that will bring out the best in the athletes and the most entertaining spectacle for the fans. And so the experience will be a lot better when they get a handle on what happened to Lance and that generation of riders and those results in those years of the tour.
If you were advising Lance during this era or during when all this stuff was going down, one, what would you have told him in terms of ways to handle this? Because from my perspective, when you have hired attorneys who don't really know the culture of the sport and don't really know the media in the sport, I think sometimes they just go with their canned, this is what we do for presidential candidates, this is what we do for other folks, and sometimes it doesn't come across as authentic or heartfelt.
Yeah.
If Bob Roll was Lance's, his advisor, how would you have told him to handle this the whole situation?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, vindication is one thing and reconciliation is something else. and to be reconciled with what we do, you have to be sorry. You have to admit to it.
Yeah.
And then you have to, you know, try your best to recompensate people for what you've realized in not just, you know, not just Lance, but everybody is eligible for reconciliation. And what athletes, I think, not just cyclists, but in all, you know, all sports, what they look for, if you listen carefully, they want to be vindicated. They want people to admit that that was the culture, that everybody was doing it. They wanted to be successful. These were the steps they believed they had to take. That's vindication. That's different. And I would recommend, not just Lance, but any athlete that's going through this, is reconciliation is you have a heartfelt apology. You're actually sorry.
Right.
Of what you did. You're not sorry because
you're caught.
Had to because everybody else was doing it and you got caught. Yeah, yeah, that's different. That's different. You actually are guilt ridden because you cheated. And that's different than saying everybody was doing it. I want to be vindicated. I want people to admit that everybody was doing it. So I would say the basic, you know, if I had to, you know, if Lance asked me, I would say, look, you know, just settle these court cases, apologize from your heart.
Yes.
And move on. And, you know, I'm not sure if that will happen. I'm not sure if that's how he feels. I'm not, you know, but I think that this is the basic opportunity that we all have in the bad things we do in our life. And everybody, you know, people tend to judge each other because their shortcomings are different.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and they, people, myself included, have this hierarchy of misdemeanors and major crimes, you know, like, oh, that's worse than this one. That's worse than this one. And you get into this stratospheric place emotionally where there's no solution. There's just oblivion. There's just a precipice. So we need to move back away from that, you know, that chasm and just deal with things in a compassionate and open way so that moving forward and that, you know, the actual emotions involved are they're not just cycling specific.
No, not
at
all.
Or sports specific. And the opportunity that we have to be reconciled with the shortcomings that we've had, the wrong things that we've done, is always there. It's always there. You just have to embrace it. And I would recommend Lance do that if he feels like, you know, he needs to. And the sport seems to be insisting on that, you know.
Yeah.
Because of the acrimony that's still out there, the
right.
Toxicity.
Yeah, you can feel it. I mean, and a big part, I think, is, you know, from my conversations with Lance over the years, there was always this sort of bully attitude towards if it's a David Walsh or Michael Ashenden, whoever it happens to be, it was, that guy's a clown, that guy's an idiot, that guy's a moron. And you're going, you know, that guy's a four-time London Times Writer of the Year. I don't think so. But, you know, sort of dismissive of the other person rather than going, okay, you know, everybody's got an opinion, everybody's got an attitude, and just, you know, we've seen it before when you get the legalese and you can tell when somebody's been, when he was on Oprah and he started defining the word cheating. And I had heard mm-hmm. that from political candidates when they'd done, you know, wrong in some way, shape, or form. Well, if you really look at the term, it means this. Rather than like, come on, dude, you know what cheating is. Let's get past that. So from my perspective, it's understanding that he was pretty brutal on a lot of people and had a lot of power. And I think that mm-hmm. more so than what he did is probably what he's still dealing with.
That's a very high probability. I remember in 2000, 2001, 2002, 03, being at the, you know, the Yellow Jersey press conference on the rest days, and the tension in the room, just, I'm like, is this a bike race? You know, or is this is the, you know, political debate? Like, what the heck? Like, it really, and Lance came in, you know, just on the offensive.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Right.
And it just, he's hardwired like that. But in the, and now that we know what was actually, you know, what, how accurate the accusations were, it makes it seem like, really pathologically disturbing. You could go into that environment and attack the people that were asking for a deeper explanation, and making some serious accusations against you, you know. So that, you know, when I looked at it then, I was like, man, oh, man, these people do not like Lance.
Right.
You know, we don't have a positive doping test to talk about, but they're already they've already convicted him of doping offenses. And I thought it was a little maybe European jealousy.
Sure.
They were not hurling the same type of accusations at their own athletes. So, you know, I maybe did not give more credence to the some of the disturbing things people had to say, including Greg LeMond,
right.
You know, our own
yep.
like superstar cycling. And Greg was right about the things he was talking about. And at the time, I just was like, dude.
Back off. I know. My thought was at the same
time. You guys can't be friends? Like, come on.
Well, and it was interesting because during the first two wins, they were friends. And
yeah.
it was great. And then when he won for the third time, all of a sudden things changed. And so it was easy
yeah.
to look at it and go, well,
right.
Greg is just bitter because now he's not the only three-time
yeah.
American champion. Now there's somebody else there. So I think a lot of us looked at it and thought, well, Greg is just – he's worried about his own legacy. So
yeah.
then, you know, then – so I think people sort of dismissed it and then realized that – he had a real point later on that it wasn't just a bitter ex-champion. It was a guy who knew more than we did, to be
yeah.
honest. Yeah. So, Bob, when you look back at your years of commentating, what moments do stick out for you as your favorite moments?
That's a great question. You know, you have such a good feeling when it's been an exciting stage and you feel engaged with what you're watching, and you're saying things that you're just sort of reflecting on the things you're watching at the moment they're happening in a way that puts into context what people are seeing sitting at home and watching, and the you know the 2000. And three Tour de France.
Yeah,
you know it was such an incredible battle between Lance and Ulrich, and to be able to be a part of that and explain things, even though not knowing entirely what was going on behind the scenes with you know Ulrich and
right
Bloden and Vino Kurov and Lance and that was a great Tour de France to call just because of how dynamic the battle was, and it gave us a chance to explain our sport in a way that was being reinforced with what people were looking at on the screen. You can't say like this has been an incredibly tight battle, you know, and you just basically see a blur of colors and one guy in the yellow jersey. It doesn't have the same resonance. It doesn't explain itself. It's not obvious. And in that race, it was. It was that obvious. And this year's Tour de France was similar.
It really was, yeah.
It was very similar. And the 2013 Tour de France was probably my, like, as far as professionally, technically, and hitting our mark and the whole production value, that's probably the best we've ever done.
Exactly.
And it seemed like Froomey had a big lead, but Quintana, man, Valverde, we kept chipping away. And then it was like a powder keg of dynamite. And then on Alpe d'Huez, the whole Tour de France came to life. And it was a long gestation period. Then that's some of the most beautiful moments in any sport when it happens like that. And, you know, Froome was a deserving winner, but like just the whole thing was so fun and so exciting. Like every day it didn't come to work like dreading, oh God, breakaway goes, God, you know.
Yeah.
And there was only a couple of days like that this whole tour. So, you know, Christian Prudhomme has designed the race so that it's hard on the riders, but it makes for incredible viewing. And when it's like that, I mean, there's nothing like it. It's just, and you feel like you've done right by the sport. You know, you feel like at the end of the day, that's what the riders are going through. And hopefully we were able to put into context what people are seeing with their eyes. And I think this year, not just me, but everybody was at their very best. And if we, you know, they'll announce the race course for next year's tour in October.
Yep.
And it wouldn't surprise me if it was pretty similar. You know, and the riders all seem like they'll be back.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to get closer and more exciting as the years go on. And it's just absolutely fabulous to follow it right now.
Bob Key, thanks so much for taking so much time. What you guys bring, you can tell when you're watching the tour, when we're getting up at 2 in the morning, whenever the heck we're watching the thing.
I feel bad for the West Coast.
Nah, we love it. We love it. I'm the trainer watching. But you for the average person and for the enthusiast, your energy comes through the set, right? And when you're excited, we know we're supposed to be excited. So that's what's cool is that, you know, a lot of us are still, in terms of bike racing tactics, we don't know what the heck's going on. But it's like, okay, Bob Key's pretty excited here. Something cool is happening. And, you know, that's what you bring. You bring that passion for the sport that's never left. And that's what I always appreciate. It's always so much fun to chat with you because you go from the Scott Molina running triathlon era all the way through Le Mans and Lance and where you're at today. And the passion has never, ever ebbed in one iota. Bob Key, thanks so much for taking time.
Pleasure.
Always love chatting.
My pleasure.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Again, this is Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U. Run Catalina.com, the Challenged Athletes Foundation, where we've raised over $65 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville. Subscribe on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.